patient. So consider for a minute that our mind is beginningless. Continuity of consciousness is beginningless. And so the continuity of our life in samsara is also beginningless. That we've taken countless rebirths under the influence of afflictions, especially ignorance. Being born and having various difficulties in our life and a little bit of pleasure, and then dying again, getting reborn, living our lives, dying again. And because we've never really thought about why are we alive or how did we get here, then our default mode is just going through life looking for pleasure and looking to avoid pain. But in the end, this doesn't get us very far, because no matter how much pleasure we experience in our life, it comes to an end. We can't take it with us when we die. And in the process of so self-centeredly looking out for ourselves, we've really tarnished our mind with a lot of seeds of negativity. So this lifetime we have the ability to reflect on our situation, to have some understanding of what it's about. And even though that understanding is totally the opposite of what society thinks and how we've been raised, still, when we examine closely, we can see its truth. And so that really provokes us to think about how to use our lives in a meaningful way. How to free ourselves from this cycle, how to free others, how to open our hearts to include other living beings. And so let's cultivate this long-term motivation to attain the highest spiritual states so that we'll have the capability to be of the greatest benefit, so that our life will have some significance at the end of the day. Okay, so our friend Ramesh asked a question a long time ago, and it got lost at the bottom of the computer package, so I'm just getting around to answering it now. Sorry about that. So he said, I understand that Lamrim topics are laid out in a certain order, so that one can study, reflect, and meditate on them to make progress on the path. As the topics for the initial level practitioner were completed, I was going over and thinking about my understanding and conviction on these topics. I noticed that I have more conviction on certain topics than others. So it seems that the conviction and realizations may not have to come in order. Is that a correct understanding? For example, the topics on death and impermanence, I seem to have a better grasp of than topics of precious human life. This also gives more energy to my practice, especially when I'm angry. I could also say the same thing about karma-related topics compared to refuge. But karma makes more sense than some of the refuge teachings. I also wonder, what are some causes for this? Very good question, yeah? Because we're taught that the topics are explained in an order, and especially with Pagongka Rinpoche, he emphasizes that you realize them in order. Okay. So here I'm going to express my own personal opinion. Yeah, I haven't seen this anywhere. It's my personal opinion. It seems to me that which topics speak to your heart and which ones you are going to have an easier time realizing is going to depend on the individual. What you're familiar with from previous lives, what culture you're born into, how much you've been exposed to some of these ideas before, you know, because, you know, the things we're more habituated with thinking about, then of course they're going to be easier to understand. I think it's also important to realize that the Lamrim was written, you know, Tisha put together the first Lamrim text, in particular for the Tibetans. So these were people who were already Buddhist. They grew up in Buddhist families. They were familiar with some of the basic Buddhist beliefs. So a lot of those basic things did not need to be explained to them. They just automatically believed them because that's how they were brought up. And that's what everybody in their culture believed. Okay, so for example, in precious human life, to really understand precious human life well, you have to have a feeling about rebirth. Yeah, because when you talk about the eight freedoms, we're free from all these unfortunate states of rebirth. Now, if you're somebody who grew up in the West, who never heard of rebirth, who doesn't understand it, who's never even thought about it, then when you're told, oh, be so happy you weren't born as an animal, you go, huh? You know, I mean, it doesn't mean anything to you. It doesn't stir you in any way, okay? Whereas something, let's say, like meditating on death, that's very clear. You don't need any kind of belief in rebirth to understand that everybody who's alive is going to die, and that includes us, and we don't know when it's going to happen, and when we die, we can't take our body and possessions and relatives with us. I mean, that's very evident. It doesn't matter what culture you're born into. Okay? Whereas precious human life is really not so evident to people. No? If you don't believe in rebirth, if you've never really thought about, you know, your fortune in life, it doesn't really mean much to you. Yeah? And especially if you don't understand what liberation is, what enlightenment is, then, oh, you're so fortunate to have a life that, by which you can attain these things, you go, you know? So, you know, it really takes a lot of background understanding to have the whole context in which that first meditation on precious human life is set out. Okay? So I can see very well for people that the meditation on impermanence and death might be much easier to understand than the meditation on precious human life. Yeah? And then in terms of what he said about karma and refuge, you know, Ramesh is Indian, so he was brought up with a viewpoint of karma since he was this little, you know. So this talking about karma, talking about cause and effect, talking about our actions having an ethical dimension that produce, you know, that produce results that influence what we experience. He was exposed to that idea since he was really little. Yeah. But understanding what a Buddha is not so easy. Yeah? Because to understand what a Buddha is, you have to understand what true cessations are, what true paths are. So you have to have some understanding of emptiness. It's not, you know, the first thing that people are really going to get. And I remember one time when I was, years ago, I was working in the office at Kopan and, you know, dealing with all the Westerners who were coming to sign up for the courses. And Lama Pasan, one of the lamas, came in and he said, "Oh, tell all these people about the qualities of the Buddha Dharma Sangha and that all just want to become Buddhas." And I kind of went, you know, I didn't say anything, but I thought, you know, if I start reading the qualities of the Buddha Dharma Sangha to these people, it's not going to mean anything to them, yeah? Because they're not going to say, "Oh, she said this, therefore I believe." Yeah? I mean, most of the Westerners who were coming, who had issues with organized religion, who had thrown out their own religions, if I start talking about, you know, the Buddha's omniscient and, you know, all these kind of things, they're going to go, you know, it doesn't mean anything to me. Okay? So you can see that a lot of these topics really have to, you know, our understanding has to do with our culture and with our family and how we were raised, what we're familiar with. So, you know, whether they're actually need to be realized 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 like this or not, I'm not so sure. Yeah, because you can, you know, they teach one way of meditating on Lamrim, where your teacher just teaches you the first meditation, and you don't even get the second one until you've realized the first one. Yeah, so you have to realize, let's say, relying on a spiritual mentor before you get precious human life, and you have to realize that before you get death and impermanence. And so that's one way to teach Lamrim. They say they don't usually teach it that much that way in public teachings now because they're trying to give the whole teaching. But, you know, again, I don't think that would apply to somebody who just walks in off the street, who hasn't been exposed to the whole Buddhist worldview beforehand and who hasn't done a lot of study beforehand. Yeah? And so while we're taught that the Lamrim has everything you need and only the Lamrim will, you know, if you just follow the Lamrim, enlightenment's ensured, actually you find out later that the Lamrim was designed as a summary for those people who have completed studying all the great classics, so that then they will have the important points on what to meditate on. Yeah? So, you know. And then you have Bhobongkhya Rinpoche's explanation, which is very different in many of the topics from some of the other teachers' explanations, or I should say the emphasis, how he emphasizes things, how he writes is very different. And, you know, he was giving that teaching before people were taking a highest class Tantra initiation. So is his audience, you know, Tibetans who grew up Buddhists, who clearly know something about the Dharma because they're about to take a highest class Tantra initiation, are they the same audience as a group of people like us who just walk in off the street? Mm-mm. Quite different. Okay. So His Holiness nowadays says that he thinks, and you can see how he teaches in the West, he often in, you know, he'll give a public talk and love and compassion and kindness and forgiveness. But when he starts in teaching the Dharma, He'll start talking about the two truths or the four truths or emptiness. He'll go right into the very deep philosophical topics. Because he says, you know, these are people who are intelligent and you have to give them something that they can chew on, you know, and examine with reasoning, because they aren't just going to kind of take what you say about, you know, multiple realms and multiple Buddhas and all these kind of things. They're not just going to take that for granted. So he actually recommends starting with the four truths and the two truths now, and the whole topic of what is mind. You know, what is mind? What is brain? You know, for the Tibetans before, they didn't even, you know, what's brain? You know what brain was in the Buddhist scriptures? It was the organ that made mucus. Yeah, because you blow your nose and your brain's up here, so. Yeah? So, you know, the Buddha didn't say that. That was just the cultural viewpoint that was prominent in Buddhist societies. Yeah? So, you know, talking about the brain is like, who is interested in that? Now you have to talk about it. Yeah? Otherwise, you know, people aren't going to understand what you're when you're talking about. Okay? So it's a very different kind of audience now. And so I think the teachings have to come about in a different kind of way. Okay? That's my opinion. Okay. So, we've been talking about the four truths for the Arya beings, for those who have realized the nature of reality directly. And so the first of those was true dukkha, or in other words, the fact that we have unsatisfactory experiences. Dukkha meaning unsatisfactory, not suffering. Okay, just unsatisfactory. So we finished talking about the eight kinds of dukkha, and then we started on the six. This sometimes is called the six faults of samsara. It's another way, or six types of unsatisfactory experience. But it's you know, six. If you want to pick faults at samsara. You know, instead of picking the faults of other sentient beings, we should sit and pick the faults of samsara. You know, this cycle of rebirth. And you know, for me personally, this six really, you know, they make a lot of sense, and you can see them without too much difficulty in your life because we've experienced them. And so it's interesting to have the Buddha point out to us things that we've experienced that we didn't know quite how to, what they meant in terms of a spiritual path. Okay, so the Buddha's explaining these things first so that we can have a very clear understanding of our present situation, because without understanding what cyclic existence is, we won't have any wish to be free of it. So he talks about its faults first. So we started it last week, but I'll review a little bit. The first one is the fault of uncertainty. And that's that, you know, wherever we're born, whatever is happening in our life, it is all uncertain. Yeah, that we can have all sorts of plans, but we cannot control what goes on. So just because we plan it does not mean it's going to happen. Just because we want it doesn't mean it's going to happen. And can you make some examples from your life, like right off the top of your head? Yeah, let's hear a couple of examples.
Getting hurt.
Yeah, getting hurt. Yeah, you wake up in the morning, I'm happy, I'm well, everything's great. You didn't have getting hurt in your calendar. But the whole situation is uncertain, and that day, conditions come together and you get hurt. Okay? What's another example?
Relationship that fails, you
So relationships, you fall in love, this is going to last forever and ever and ever, and it's never going to end. Yeah. And then you grow apart and it ends. Or maybe you don't grow apart, but the other person dies and it ends. Yeah. So all these fantasies that we have of things being permanent and predictable and secure, they are just that, simply fantasies. Yeah. And so you can see in our lives, the more we cling on to permanence and wanting things to stay the same and be familiar, the more unhappy we get in our lives, because change is the very nature of our life. Yeah. So we've seen just coming to the Abbey, you have a plan of what you're going to do for offering service in the morning, and then 5 minutes later, the whole plan is out the window because something else came up and you have to adjust to the new circumstance. Yeah. And you can go, but. And the response is, but it changed, you know? So we can see that when we fight reality, reality wins. Yeah? When we say, you know, things can't change like that, they're not supposed to change. This person's supposed to be like this, and this, that situation's supposed to be like that. That all of our rules are just made up things, and the reality of the situation is going to be the reality of the situation. That's it. Okay? So things are uncertain, and yet every day we wake up and everything seems so concrete, and we have our plan and our expectations, and yet actually we're floating in space, aren't we? Okay, then the second fault of cyclic existence. So you can see here, if uncertainty is the fault of samsara, then the fact that nirvana is an unconditioned, permanent state brings relief from all this change that occurs under the influence of ignorance. Okay, then the second one is dissatisfaction. Okay, so although we have no lack of experience in cyclic existence, they say we've been born as everything in all the different realms. We've experienced all of the samsaric pleasures, not once, but many times. Yeah, and yet we haven't attained any kind of satisfaction in our life. And that's really true, isn't it? I mean, if we had attained some kind of satisfaction, we wouldn't be here tonight. But no matter what's going on in our life, we aren't completely satisfied. Yeah. We don't really have enough money or financial security. We don't really have enough love. We don't really have enough appreciation from others. We don't have enough pleasure. We can think of, off the top of our head, how many things can we think of that we would like changed and improved? Starting with the carpeting. Yeah? I mean, who's satisfied with this carpeting? Blah. Okay? Then, who's satisfied with the windows? If I were building it, I would put more windows that opened in. Wouldn't you? Okay. Who's satisfied with the color of the walls? Yeah. I think they could be a brighter color. And who likes all that stuff on the top of the windows? Especially the one with the big dark streak? That is totally unsatisfactory. Yeah? And who, you know, anybody satisfied with the wires there in the middle of the floor? No. So if we look around, I mean, we want to revamp everything and remake everything from floor to ceiling. Not to mention all the people in between. Those are the ones that we really want to remake, don't we? Yeah. It's like, Nate, I think you should wear your hair another way. You know? No, not that way, you know, the other side. Yeah. No, really, I think you should, you know, care it. Yeah, shave it off. Yeah. But but don't you dare put it in the garbage or down the drain. But you know, we can go around to everybody. Yeah? I mean, just remember a couple of weeks ago I stuck my foot in my mouth. I was talking about the glasses that people have, you know, the new stylish glasses, these big brown, black framed ugly ones, and how ugly they were, but how everybody got them because they were in style. And there were a couple people in the room wearing these. Which I didn't notice until I started to look around. So, you know, but yeah, we have all sorts of ways in which, you know, we wish things were different. Yeah? So whatever we have is not sufficient, it's not good enough, whatever we do. You know, are you satisfied with who you are in your life? Yeah? Are you as good as all your siblings are? Yeah? Do you get enough praise from your parents? Do you get enough approval from your friends? Do you feel like you're a good enough person? Yeah? Do we do enough? Do we have enough? Are we enough? You know, we're plagued by all these thoughts of deficiency, aren't we? Yeah. And so whatever we have or do or are is not sufficient, is not satisfactory. Our theme song is more and better. Yeah? I want more and I want better. Yeah, and then so we run around all day looking for more and better. We get something. Does it bring us satisfaction? No. Yeah. Because that ends and we still want more. And even though it was better than what we had before, we can still think of something even better than that. Yeah. So, you know, it's like our mind is in a state of permanent complaining. It shouldn't be like this. I don't like this. I want more. I want better. Why isn't the world different? And so we make ourselves quite miserable, don't we? Yeah. So there's the dissatisfaction that is just occurs with the ripening of karma. And then there's the mental dissatisfaction that we put on top of that, which is all of our complaints, all of our shoulds and shouldn'ts and unmet expectations. Yeah, and so this is kind of how we are, isn't it? You know, are your parents what you want them to be? Are you what your parents want you to be? Yeah? Are the cats what you want them to be?
No.
And for sure we aren't what they want us to be either. Yeah? So, it's very interesting, you know, just to meditate on this and think, you know, this is a quality of cyclic existence. Yeah? And the only way I'm going to be free from it completely is to be out of cyclic existence. I can temper it a little bit by creating a sense of satisfaction and contentment in my mind, by releasing my unrealistic expectations, releasing my attachment and my craving. That will certainly help a lot. But I can't be totally free of it until liberation. Then the third fault of cyclic existence is abandoning our body repeatedly. So, in other words, dying again and again and again. Okay. So some people think, oh, rebirth's great, you know, because it just means you're going to be born again. But birth is the cause of death, so it also means you're going to die again. Yeah. And so when we think about it, death is not what we look forward to. It's not our idea of what we want to do on a beautiful Saturday morning. Yeah, it's death means separation from what is familiar. It's separation from the people we care about. It's separation from the whole ego identity that we've built up and all the surroundings that reinforce this. Yeah, and yet, you know, as long as we're born in cyclic existence, this separation is a given. Yeah, it's like at the end of one life, we craved for another life, we clung to having another life, we got another life. Then we're faced with the same thing of uncertainty, dissatisfaction, and again, dying. Yeah. So, you know how they say be careful of what you want because you might get it? So this is, you know, the mind that is craving, I want a body, I want a birth, you know, because we're craving to have some basis for the self, for the I. Then we get that, but then we have everything that is attendant upon that. Yeah? So, always getting born, always dying, always getting born, always dying. You know, they always say, you know, if we could bring together all the mother's milk we ever drank in all of our previous lives, it would fill the ocean, you know. But if they could bring together all the obituaries about us in all of our lives, at least those lives we had at obituaries, you know. I don't think as a cat or a frog that you have an obituary. Yeah. Although maybe some people do that. But, you know, if we brought together all the obituaries of all of our previous lives, I mean, it would more than fill the biggest computer in the world, you know, because these things are beginningless. Okay? And then the next one, the fourth one, goes with that. Third one was dying repeatedly, abandoning our body again and again. Fourth one is taking a new body again and again. So, again, because we haven't realized the nature of reality, and we misapprehend how things exist, and we're full of wrong views, then, you know, death does not bring an end to our misery. Death is just the prelude to taking birth again. And each birth, again, it's not like you start out at the beginning of your life and, oh, isn't this great, you know. You start out being a baby where you can't control anything, where you can't communicate to anybody, where you're totally helpless and at the whim of others. Yeah? And, you know, then you have to, if you're fortunate enough to be born as a human being, you know, then you have to go to kindergarten all over again, you know, and first grade and piano lessons. Yeah. And play football again and again, or volleyball, or whatever it is, and then you have to go through adolescence again. This is the one where people tell me, now I've really had enough of rebirth, when I think that I have to go through adolescence again. Yeah, Because is adolescence a fun time? No. We were pretty much, well, I don't know about you, I was kind of a basket case during adolescence, you know. I was confusion incorporated. Yeah. So, you know, do you really want to go through adolescence again? And then looking for a job again? And then getting in another relationship again? And then having kids again? And having to do all of that again? And getting a job again? And this is all if you're fortunate enough to have a precious human life. I mean, if you're not, then it's, you know, you get born as a cat, and then, you know, or a dog, and then you have to go through that. And our cats and dogs here are quite pampered. You go to India, the situation of the animals is horrific. You know, there's lots of little mama dogs who have tons of puppies. Most of them have fleas and mange. Yep. A lot of them die of hunger or just of scratching themselves to death. You know, once when I was coming down from Dharamsala, we stopped to get tea, and they were doing some road work, and there was a dog by the, off to the side, and he had fallen in the hot tar.
Oh.
And he was just covered in tar and dying. You know, it was awful. And then the donkeys that you know, are burdened with so much stones to carry around. Or maybe you're born as a racehorse, yeah, and you're really manipulated and, you know, not treated very well by human beings. So, you know, this whole thing of being born again and again and again, it's not, it's like, you know, dying, being born. It's like you're on the merry-go-round, you know, and you keep going round and you keep going up and down. We'll come to that a little bit. But it, in the end, none of it gets you anywhere. Okay, then the fifth one is repeatedly changing status. Okay, so here is how none of it gets you anywhere. Because from one life to the next, sometimes we're born high status in cyclic existence. We have, let's say we're born as a celestial being with all sorts of pleasure. Then the next life, karma to be reborn as a hungry ghost ripens. And you're running around, you know, frantic, trying to get food and drink, and can't get any. And then the life after that, you're born as, you know, Marilyn Monroe or JFK, and you have all this fame and glory and blah, blah. And then the life after that, you're born in the hell realm. And so in samsara, you know, we go up and down and up and down and up and down. You know? So there's some people who have the idea of karma that you just go continuously up. No. You know, because if we look at our lives, you know, I mean, we have a good rebirth as a human being now. Do we create only good karma? No, we create a lot of negative karma. So why should we expect that our rebirths are only going to go up and up and up? If we expect that result, then we have to make the causes continually virtuous and more virtuous and more virtuous. But we don't, you know. We have a good rebirth and then we spend it creating all sorts of problems. Yeah. And then so... And samsara, up and down and up and down and up and down in our rebirths. Yeah. So it's never quite sure when we're going to die, where we're going to be reborn. Because yeah. A lot depends. It depends on what your mental state is. When you die, it depends on what karma is strong in your mind, so that it's going to ripen first. There's so many factors that enter into it that we can't just take, for example, you know, granted that we're always going to have better and better rebirths. Yeah. So when you think about this, it's quite scary. Mm-hmm. And especially when you think about the people who have, you know, amazing power and fame and riches in this lifetime, but use it basically to create a lot of negative karma. And then, you know, where are they going to be reborn? Yeah. You can be very famous in this lifetime and have a lot of power, and within the space of one breath, all of that's gone, and you're born in a horrible rebirth, a horrendous rebirth. Yeah. So going up and down all the time. And even within one life, yeah, our status is going up and down, up and down. You know, I think of some of the Tibetans before 1959, who, you know, some of them who were wealthy Tibetans, and then they had to flee to India, leaving everything behind. They got to India. Nobody cared that they were the Tibetan royalty. They couldn't take all their bags of gold with them. They arrived in India with nothing. And, you know, like everybody else, they had to go work on the roads. Yeah. And you hear stories like His Holiness's, one of His Holiness's doctors at the Menzikon. You know, he didn't leave Tibet right away. He was, you know, he had been a very prominent doctor before, and then after 59, he was imprisoned. And he, where he was imprisoned, they were starving. And he tells the story of how they would pick through other people's feces looking for undigested grain to eat, because that was the only food around. Yeah. So, you know, in so many of these stories, I mean, in all the communist countries, you know, people who were very wealthy, Chinese, with the communist revolution, sent out to the countryside and humiliated, and, you know, their status was lower than the low. Same in with Russia, you know, under Stalin. So, you know, people's status up and down and up and down, according to the political situation, or according to the stock market. You know, some people have wealth, then the stock market crashes. Yeah, then those same people zip. And they're frantic, they don't know what to do. Yeah, because it's so strange anyway, you know, that you're rich simply because you have a sheet of paper with a bunch of zeros on it. Yeah, because you have a computer screen with a bunch of zeros. And what's important is not the number in front of the zeros. It doesn't matter if that's a 1 or a 9. The important thing is how many zeros follow that number on the screen. Yeah? It's so weird, isn't it? It's totally made up, totally fabricated by the mind. And yet, people's happiness and unhappiness are dependent on it. You know, on the system that we completely made up. And that, you know, then the factors change. You invest in one thing, and you think the stock is going to go up, and instead it goes down. You know, kerplunk. Yeah. Or you invest in real estate and then it burns down. Or you, you know, who knows? What are, I mean, I'm sure people can give some more examples. So this constant fluctuation of status in samsara, no kind of security whatsoever. And yet that's what people work for, isn't it? We all want to be secure. Yeah, the idea is to work hard when you're young so you have financial security when you're old. But who has financial security when they're old. Even people who are very wealthy don't feel like they're totally secure. Yeah? Because they could lose it all very easily. Yeah? So getting arrogant about our social status is really ridiculous. Okay, then sixth is having no friends. You're gonna go, whoa, wait, hold on. I have lots of friends. Look at my Facebook account. Look at how many people like me on Facebook. I have all these thumbs up. You know, I have a lot of friends. But, okay, when we get sick and old, how many friends do we have? How do we treat people who are sick or old? Do you go visit all your grandparents and your aunts and uncles who are sick and old? It's much more fun to stay with people your age who are in good health and have a good time. Yeah? And yet one day that's going to be us. Yeah? Old and sick. And maybe some people will come visit, and maybe they won't. And even if they come visit, are you going to have a good time with them? That's to be seen. Yeah? But that is more the superficial meaning of not having friends. The real meaning of the sixth one is when we die alone. You know, and you can have as many people as you want surrounding you when you die. You can have incredible obituaries. Your funeral could be televised. But when you die alone. And our mind goes on alone. And so maybe you have some fortune and you have some Dharma friends who at the time of death will kind of remind you of the Dharma and remind you how to think. Maybe you have that. Yeah. But it's not like we can say, oh, I'm having, you know, the appearances, I'm having very strange appearances. Can I hold somebody's hand as I die and go through the bardo, you know, with mommy and daddy protecting me? That's not going to happen. So, I mean, when we die, we're on our own, and it's only our Dharma practice that's going to be the important thing. Our friends can't come with us, and our friends can't make it easier. You know? Muhammad Ali's funeral was today. Yeah, they had a Muslim ceremony yesterday and then a broader public ceremony today. And I happened to go online in the middle of it, so I listened to some of it. And his wife was amazing. I didn't listen to her, everything she said. But she was really using it as a teaching moment, because she said that's what he wanted, was his life and death to be something that people can learn from so that the world would become a better place. And she was really doing that. It was quite beautiful what she said and what some of the other people said. Really inspiring people to have good values and to be strong in the face of adversity and so on. But Muhammad Ali is not here and he didn't attend the ceremony. And he doesn't know what went on at the ceremony. And he doesn't know all the nice things people said about him or how meaningful they felt his life was. He's having a totally different experience now that we don't know what it is. Yeah? And the basis for Muhammad Ali, the body and mind, yeah, are gone. So, yeah, it's strange to think about, isn't it? Everybody has this inspiring funeral and memorial service for you. And you're off, who knows what in the world he's experiencing. You know, but he's experiencing it alone, and nobody, you know, only the state of his own mind can make it better for him. So it doesn't really matter how many fights he won at the end of the day. It doesn't matter. Yeah. What matters is the kind of person he was. And I think that's what most people found most inspiring was, you know, the kind of person he was. Okay. But it's something for us to think about too, especially if we're attached to other people. And, you know, we always want to have those people around us. We always want to, you know, be able to lean and depend on somebody else. To think that, you know, at the time of death, our consciousness goes on alone. And it doesn't matter. Yeah, if they televise your funeral or, you know, you have a million of these on Facebook or, yeah. Or if you planned your funeral meticulously, and so they have exactly the color flowers that you wanted, and you looked exactly perfect, you know, in your coffin. You know, like that one movie star who had a facelift after she died, whatever she did, so she would look more beautiful in the coffin. You know, it's like you aren't even there. And your experience is something totally different. Mm-hmm. Okay, so these six are very, very potent to do some serious meditation on. And, you know, really think about them, imagine them, remember our experience of having had these, you know, and what that means in our life. And then the conclusion we want to draw is, you know, if I want to be free from these altogether, then I have to attain liberation. And in the meantime, if I want to lessen the anguish from these six while I'm still in cyclic existence, then I have to release my attachment. Yeah. And so, of course, releasing attachment, releasing anger, resentment, and so on. So then the text goes on, it says, these are condensed into three. One, the fact that in samsara nothing is reliable. So you have the unreliability of one, the body that we attained. The body comes, it goes, its health changes. Yeah. Second, the people who help and harm, we're not always with the same people. And the same people don't always help us or always harm us. And they aren't always around. Excellent resources. Again, they are unreliable. Sometimes we have them. Sometimes they're gone. We don't have them. And then fourth is friends. Now, sometimes we have friends. Sometimes we don't. But at the end of the day, we go on alone. And then two, is that the samsaric pleasures you experience are never fully satisfying. And he says, this is easy to understand. Is it easy for you to understand? Do you get it? Yeah? It really is very worthwhile to spend some time and look at everything we've done in our life and see if we've ever been satisfied with any of it. And then three, the fact of entering samsara since beginningless time. So there's no beginning to our series of rebirths, so no beginning to our series of deaths. Okay? And so, you know, the point of this is to get really disillusioned and disenchanted with cyclic existence. Yeah? And see that the nature of cyclic existence is the five aggregates that are under the control of ignorance and polluted karma. And, you know, to therefore desire liberation from those aggregates, from the whole situation of cyclic existence with all these disadvantages as part of it. Okay? So use your meditation to come out with a very strong determination to be free. And then think about other sentient beings experiencing these same six in the same way that we have, and generate very strong compassion for other living beings. That no matter who they are, what they look like, they're experiencing these. And you can really see, you know, my favorite politician is, you know, he's a winner, and he's stuck on being a winner. I'm a winner, I'm always a winner. Yeah? He experiences these six, you know. He's not always a winner. Yeah. And no matter how much you win, at death time you lose everything. Yeah? So making your happiness contingent on being a winner is a setup for a lot of pain. You know, also during life, not only at the time of death. Okay, so that pertains to us, it pertains to other people. So I think it's helpful to, you know, kind of start with yourself and then think of other people who have the same problem. And you think of people that you don't like, and it helps you generate compassion for them. You think of people who you're jealous of, and it helps you stop being jealous of them because you realize that they have the same, they're under the same, you know, disadvantages as all of us are. Okay? And then the next outline is contemplating the specific types of dukkha. So our author says, humans also have dukkha similar to those of the lower realms, so we experience painful situations like the lower realms. The demigods are oppressed by jealousy towards the gods. The desire realm gods suffer from dying and falling below after their death, and from intimidation and anxiety, and also being torn to pieces, killed, and expelled. And then having obstructions, the higher realm gods, those in the form and formless realms, who have different levels of concentration, they also enjoy no freedom. Although their concentration is good, it is in their nature to fall in the end. To generate disenchantment, reflect in detail on other forms of dukkha as well. Okay, so that's what our author said. I thought to read a little bit from the Lamrim Chenmo about the some of these other realms that they talk about. So we've already talked about the, you know, the hellish realms, the hungry ghost realms, the animal realms. Yeah, so now they're talking more about the suffering of, well, I'll start here where it says the suffering of human beings. From what has been explained above, you should understand that the suffering of human beings consists of the pain of and hunger, the pain of hunger and thirst, unpleasant sensations of heat and cold, and the suffering of searching for sustenance and becoming fatigued. So you drop, you shop until you drop. It is also birth, old age, sickness, death, and so on. The seven that I have already explained before. So like having problems and not getting what you want and those kinds of things. Furthermore, you should understand human suffering according to the following two citations. So the first one's from Vasubandhu. And he says, it is apparent that humans also have all the sufferings of the miserable realms. Tormented by pain, they are like hell beings. So if you get some severe illness or injury, deprived, they are like those in the Lord of Death's world, the hungry ghosts. So people who have no food, who have no water, yeah, it's like a hungry ghost realm. Humans also have the suffering of animals, in that the powerful use force to hurt the weak and oppress the weak. And these sufferings are just like the river, they keep coming. Some suffer from poverty. For others, suffering arises from discontent. The suffering of yearning is unbearable. All of them quarrel and can be killed. Human experience? And then for the 400, Aryadeva says, for the privileged, pain is mental. For the common people, it is physical. Day after day, both types of pain afflict this world. Yeah. So some people have more physical pain, some people have more mental pain. Okay, how many of you have had more physical pain in your life? How many of you have had more mental pain? Yeah, it's the way it is when I go to developed countries, everybody says that. And the mental pain is excruciating, isn't it? Okay, then the suffering of the demigods. So here, the friendly letter, who's the author?
Nagarjuna.
He says, also the demigods, by their very nature, experience great mental suffering because of their hatred of the splendor of the deities. So the thing is, on Mount Meru, yeah, the celestial beings live on the top and the demigods live below them. So you have the gated community and you have the inner city. Yeah, or you have the slums. And the demigods still have it pretty good. But, you know, they have kind of really nice slums compared to, let's say, the animals or whatever. But when they compare themselves to the gated communities of the god realms, they're just so jealous they can't bear it. So they fight with the god realms. And as the story goes, you know, they have the biggest legal battle in the world going on that the court hasn't settled, so they kill each other over, because they have these trees which grow like fantastically delicious fruits. The roots and the trunks are in the demigod realm, but the branches hang over the god realm. So the gods pick this delicious fruit, and the demigods don't get it. Yeah, so they filed the case and said, you know, the roots and the trunks are in our realm and we deserve to get it. And the gods say, but the branches and the fruit are in our realm, so forget you. And then the demigods get mad. Yeah, and they fight with the god realms. So, you know, the god realms have some big tall buildings where they warehouse all their wealth and fruit, and the demigods send these airplanes that crash into the buildings and destroy them. Something like that. So although they are intelligent, they do not see the truth. This is the demigods. Because of the mental obscuration, characteristic of this realm of rebirth. In other words, they are tortured by their unbearable envy of the deity's wealth. Because of this, they fight with the deities and endure many sufferings, such as having their bodies cut and split apart. They are intelligent, but they have mental obscurations, fruitions of past karma, which make it impossible for them to see the truth from within their situation. So they're intelligent. They have degrees from Harvard and Yale and Smith and wherever. But they can't understand what samsara is. They don't get it. Yeah. So they have big degrees, big jobs, and no understanding of the nature of their life. Yeah, because so much karma obscures them. So it's interesting. One text says that they're animals, but a Sangha in the Yogacharya Bhumi places them in the realm of the deities. So it's interesting, isn't it? Some people say, no, they're animals, some people deities. Okay, then we have the reflection on the suffering of the deities. So we start out here with the deities of the desire realm. So they have the sufferings of dying and falling to lower rebirths. Two, the suffering of anxiety. And three, the sufferings of being gnashed, killed, cut, gashed, killed, and banished. Okay, so the first of those, the suffering of dying and falling. So the friendly letter says, although the deities have great pleasure in heaven, the suffering of dying is there. There is even greater than that. The wise who understand this cease to create attachments for the perishable heavens. So if you're really smart, you don't want to get born there, because although you might have sense pleasure deluxe while you're alive, the time of death is excruciating. Okay? So deities derive pleasure from indulging their sensual desires, yet greater than this is the tremendous suffering they experience while dying. When they become aware of the five signs of death about which the same text says, and so they experience these five signs of death, and as these signs of approaching death come, they totally freak out. You know, I mean, incredible pain. So their bodies turn an unattractive color. So these are beings who were like all Marilyn Monroes and Rambos, you know? I mean, they had these attractive bodies, they had so much sense pleasure deluxe, people were always praising them, how gorgeous they were. They never, you know, got sick or aged or anything until right near the end, then their bodies start to decay. So their bodies start to decay, they start to smell, all their flower garlands, you know, kind of wither, and nobody wants to be with them. So it's kind of like being in junior high again, and you're really popular for a long time, and then something happens and none of your friends will speak to you again. And remember the pain of when that happens? Even you weren't one of the popular kids to start out with. You know, you had some friends and then something happened. Because it happened to all of us, didn't it? I mean, who went through junior high unscathed? Yeah? You know? We were all with our little group, and then something happened, and everybody hated us and wouldn't talk with us, and all of a sudden we were the kids who had cooties. Yeah, remember that? Well, that's kind of what the God realm goes through. You know, they're like on the up and up, and then when they age, nobody wants to come near them or talk to them or anything. And they're going, but, you were my friend, but, you liked me, but, I liked you, but, we had a good time together. And nobody will give them the time of day. Do you remember how painful that was? Or was I the only one who went through that in junior high? Yeah, you went through it too?
No.
No? Oh, lucky you.
I had bad moments.
Okay, so their cushions become uncomfortable. Well, we have that one already. Their flower garlands wilt and their clothing smells. We have that one too. An unaccustomed sweat breaks out over their bodies. Hot flashes. The five signs that signal the deities in heaven foretelling their death and departure therefrom, are similar to the signs that foretell death for humans on earth. You know? And in many ways it's true. When your body starts to decay and your flower garlands melt, I mean wither, yeah, and your ice cream melts, then your friends disappear. Okay? I mean, many of us, our parents have died, and you watch them die as they, you know, how they grow old and the, you know, what they go through. And, you know, when you're really attached to your body and you lose the power of your body, it's hell, you know. And when you're very attached to looking good and you no longer look good, very miserable. Yeah. And then you have the suffering of Medicare. Not knowing if they're going to pay your stuff or not pay your stuff. Okay, then there's the God realms, also the suffering of falling to the lower realms. So the friendly letter says they must take leave of the divine world. If their merit has run out, then powerless, they will become animals, hungry ghosts, or denizens of hell. Okay, then they have the suffering of anxiety. Deities with vast stores of merit gain the most desirable objects. Upon seeing them, deities of lesser merit become anxious and experience great anguish and pain on this account. Yeah. So somebody has more delegates than I do at the convention. You know? You can see what goes on. Or somebody got more thumbs up on their whatever than I did. And you become anxious, jealous, you know, bummed out. And then the God realms, even though they have so much pleasure all the time, the suffering of cut, gash, kit, killed, and banished. When deities fight with demigods, they undergo the pain of having their limbs and minor extremes cut off, having their bodies split apart and being killed. Okay, not to mention IEDs, brain trauma, PTSD. When their heads are cut off, they had ISIS then too. When their heads are cut off, they die, but their other limbs regenerate after being cut off or gashed. And they survive. As regards banishment, when there is a battle, the more powerful deities expel the weaker deities from their homes. And then here's another quote from Vasubandhu. Deities who indulge in sense pleasure are not happy in mind. They are burned by an inner fire, sparked by the infection of sensual desire. How can there be happiness for those whose minds are distracted? Since their minds are not under control and undistracted even for a moment. They are by nature disturbed and agitated. They will never be calm, like a fire that has wood for fuel and that rages whipped by the wind. Now that's the joys of living in sense pleasure deluxe. Also, they are like invalids not long recovered from an illness who eat improperly and get sick again. Okay, and then the deities of the form and formless realms. So these beings are born there because as human beings they develop very strong meditative stabilization that was the karma that led to their being born in these form and formless realm absorptions. So the deities of the highest realms, the form and formless, though they escape these sufferings, nevertheless die in possession of afflictions and obscurations. Okay, so they've gone up and up and up in terms of the levels of samsara, and they have this magnificent meditative equipoise, but they have no renunciation of samsara. And so when the karma for having the being born in these realms is over, then, you know, their whole world disintegrates and they fall down to the lower realms because they still have afflictions and obscurations. Because they have no control over their future dwelling place, even they suffer on account of dysfunctional tendencies, on account of afflictions. Okay, and then here's another quotation from Discussion of the Requisite Collections. I'm not sure what text that is. Those in the former formless realms are beyond the suffering of pain and the suffering of change. By nature, they have the bliss of meditative concentration. They remain motionless for an eon. But even this is most assuredly not liberation. After they had counted on it, they will again fall. Though it may seem as though they have transcended the turbulence of the miserable realms, yet like birds soaring in the sky, they cannot stay forever though they try. And like an arrow shot with the strength of a child, they will fall back down in the end. Just as butter lamps that burn for a long time are in fact perishing in every moment, they are afflicted by the changes of the suffering of conditionality. Okay, so, you know, after we think of the general disadvantages of cyclic existence, then to think of the disadvantages of the different realms in particular. And then Jason Kapa says at the end of this chapter, reflect in this way on the general and specific sufferings of the five or six types of being. Five or six types depending upon if you say the demigods are their own realm or they're together with either the animals or the god realm. Then, when you have become disgusted with cyclic existence, you will wonder about its causes. What causes cyclic existence? And so that leads us into the second of the four truths, the origins of dukkha, which we'll get into next week. Any questions or comments? Yeah.
I'm still, after hearing the general teachings about the god realms for years, I'm still puzzled on why that is considered an upper rebirth. Despite all the goodness, they don't have the causes to be able to concentrate and focus dharma and to be able to cultivate the qualities.
Some of the devas do practice the dharma. Yeah, the devas in the desire realm, some of them practice the dharma. Because there's a lot of things in the scriptures. I mean, even when you give teachings, you invite the devas in the area to come. And there's stories, I mean, Sakya, the king of gods, and Brahma, and Ishvara, and all these beings, they respect the dharma, and they come hear the teachings with all their followers. Yeah, but so some of them practice the dharma. Some of them are so entranced with their sense pleasure deluxe that they aren't interested. But that's true in the human realm as well, isn't it? Yeah, but it's considered a higher rebirth because in that life they have more sense pleasure deluxe than we human beings have. Okay, so it's considered higher in terms of the pleasures of that life. In terms of gaining liberation, a precious human life is more valuable.
Okay. I just sometimes think that that's... I hopefully will never create the causes to have that. Unless I go with the Dharma mind, you know, it doesn't seem to be a good use of time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we're learning about the disadvantages. So, you know, our mind of attachment doesn't get hung up and think, oh, I'm so poor and miserable this lifetime. You know, what if I were born in Beverly Hills and, you know, and I had this and this and this and, oh, that sounds good, you know, and develop a craving for that kind of rebirth. So this kind of teaching is given so that we cut that.
As you were going through all of them, there seemed like a lot of similarities in the disadvantages between between all the different realms. So I was just kind of wondering, like, so if some of them can practice and all of that, does karma, is it more intense in those? Like, if you do a negative action, does it kind of propel more or beneficial?
You know, when you look in all the realms, it's not so many beings can really practice. Hell realm beings, extremely difficult to practice because they're in constant pain. Hungry ghosts, can't practice because you're running around hungry and thirsty. Animals, we try. Yeah, doesn't work. Yeah, so three lower realms, forget it. Gods in the form and formless realms, who are in the really high echelons of samsara in terms of the beautiful experiences they have, they can't practice because they're in their single point of concentration and they're attached to it, no way to generate. Yeah. Some of the form realm gods, yeah, some of them are interested in Dharma, not all of them. Yeah. Human beings, a handful are interested in the Dharma. Most human beings could care less. And even if they cared, they don't have the opportunity to encounter the Dharma or to practice. So it's actually very rare within the six realms of samsara to find beings who have the opportunity to practice, who have all the conditions come together. Yeah. So we might think, oh, well, there's a lot. But, you know, first of all, not every human life is a precious human life. And then everybody who has a precious human life doesn't use it. A lot of them go wasted. And then even you have a precious human life, obstacles come such that you can't practice. So it's not so easy.
Mm-hmm. Is there any sort of commentary about like the lifespan of a lot of these existences? In terms of like how long do the sufferings last, especially for the lower realms? Because the formless, they, you know, meditate for an eon. So if there's any like hell beings like that, you know, moment of suffering, it's not
going. No, most of these are quite long. Yeah. Yeah. Both the hell beings and the form and formless realms. Yeah, quite long. Yeah?
I was thinking when we were going through the six disadvantages that everyone has those.
Mm-hmm.
And we may look at someone who has more material wealth and say, oh, I'd rather be them. But really the only people who have more satisfaction in life are those with less attachment than we have.
That's it. Yeah. The people, we think, oh, the people who are richer are going to have more satisfaction. They often have more fear. Yeah, when you're poor, nobody's going to rip you off. When you're rich, yeah, people, you know, want to get their hands on your stuff. And they will lie and cheat and deceive you. And so be careful of who you're jealous of. Because when we're jealous of somebody, we don't see their suffering. We only see what they have, that we don't have, that we want. But we don't see the suffering that they have that we're free of.
Many lotto winners become incredibly depressed.
Hmm?
Many people who win the lottery and everything, they just become incredibly depressed.
Oh, yeah.
Because of everyone comes out of the woodwork saying, hey, can I have this? Can I have that? Can I you have this? That?
Yep. Did you have something?
I was thinking about the question at the beginning and how for myself the contemplations on precious human life are very important for the death meditation. Because if I wasn't thinking about why this life is precious human mm-hmm. life, then to realize that my lifespan is dwindling and it's limited, if I didn't believe in another life or I didn't realize that I need to practice the Dharma, I could just say, oh, I have a limited amount of time to indulge in the worldly concerns.
Yeah.
And so for me, those two go together very closely.
Okay. Just saying that for you, having the meditation on the precious human life first and then thinking that it doesn't last forever, is that sequence works really well for you and invigorates you. And that's why they're taught in that order, you know. But you're a person who believes in rebirth, okay? So because you believe in rebirth, then when you see the fortune and the opportunity of this life and know that it's not going to last forever, then this feeling of urgency comes and inspiration and you want to practice. But for somebody who doesn't, yeah, then they may understand death more, but they may not know how to use that to make their mind happy, but they still could think, oh, you know, I am going to die, so some of this running around doesn't really make much sense. They could still think like that.
Yeah. I also had, before I started really focusing on those things, I had cycled through the Lamrim with brief meditations many times.
Right.
Before I started really sitting down and focusing.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, getting a whole overview of the entire Lamrim is very good, because when you do that, then what you learn at the end helps your meditations at the beginning, and your meditations at the beginning, you know, invigorate your meditations at the end. And the same way, you know, why does refuge come before karma in the Lamrim structure? Because, you know, when you see you're going to die and you get concerned about your next rebirth, then you want to take refuge because you want some spiritual guidance. So the refuge meditation comes. And then what's the first advice the Buddha gives you? Keep good ethical conduct so you learn karma. Yeah. And also, if you have some faith in the Buddha Dharma Sangha, it can help you have faith in the functioning of cause and effect, because the details of karma are something, you know, only a Buddha understands, and so we have to trust the scriptures on those. So if you have very deep refuge, it becomes easier to trust those scriptures. Okay. So you can see, you know, I wasn't saying in the initial discussion that we, you know, everything was set up cuddywompers. You know, I wasn't saying that, but I was just saying that for some people, the present structure, you know, may not work so well. Yeah?
Someone says, this reminds me that I have to practice Dharma purely, because if we practice Dharma with attachment to the Dharma itself, here she means like becoming very proud that we are a practitioner or just taking it for granted, it can harm us as we are dying, because we may be in such a condition that we can't remember it, the Dharma, and die with frustration in the mind.
Yeah. So you read the last part a little bit quickly before?
If we practice in that way,
yeah.
We may not remember the Dharma.
Okay, yeah, so we may not remember the Dharma when we die, because we're trying to use the Dharma to build up our sense of self. What a great practitioner I am. Yeah, well, you're not remembering the Dharma when you're alive, if you think like that. So chances of remembering it when you're dying are slim too. Okay, so we'll end this evening and continue next week, hopefully.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtue was sound. such and resi. May you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of
explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Ekshravasti and